All right.
Where were we?
The rich David Carolla.
It's really interesting to me that the groups are no one sat contiguously, but no one sat entirely dispersed either. It's sort of they're all sort of separated by one. It may just be accidental. I don't know.
That's math.
But he always sits over there, and then normally it's me anyway.
It's a small enough group that if they're not sitting together,
maybe it's just any random shuffle that isn't. You got
to. I'm sitting in the front class. Far from my group, but I don't want to sit in the back.
We went to I was sitting in the same place.
So we chose not-for-profit radio as a group in general. And we kind of selected three different sectors, I suppose.
What you really did is you chose a sector and you chose three different groups.
Groups within that, yeah. So three different groups within a larger group. And the three groups were NPR, being the largest and most distributed. Then Pacifica Radio, which is not-for-profit, located in California and in New York. And they're like the middle tier in terms of size. And then a little tiny not-for-profit radio station that's run out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, called WPKN. And
what do they call it?
WPKN are the colors.
PKN.
And basically what we wanted to do was kind of and contrast the various types of groups that are formed around these stations, the various kinds of activities that they're involved in, what a typical member might be like, and you know, as well as entry level, I should say.
I have a personal experience with Pacifica Radio. Mm-hmm. I actively listen to it in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. To the Berkeley KPFA station, and I listened to it because it was very interesting, the information, because it was alternative radio and alternative information that I wasn't able to get anywhere else, perhaps online, but I started to notice that there were a lot of subgroups forming out of that in the Bay Area, San Francisco, Berkeley. It's a much more leftist community, and I started attending a lot of...
Much more leftist than what? Than New York, you mean? Or than the country as a whole?
Any other experience I've had in the
probably
the
rest of the country.
Maybe Cambridge.
Very intense.
Cambridge and parts of Brooklyn.
I mean, any other experience I've had also. But I started attending some of the activities that were not necessarily political. They were like poetry readings or dance activities. And it just so happened that I noticed that there were... it was a closer community that I... even thought about, like, the same people would go to all the events, and KPFA would advertise the events, talk about the events, have guests that would talk about the events, and then report back to the community about the specific events, like Michael Moore came to speak at San Francisco State, like, a lot of activities that were very much networked within the radio station, and I found it, like, a very interesting phenomenon, because I wasn't necessarily part of the more community-oriented activities, but because I started listening to it, it just kind of brought me into this more physical community within the area.
Do you listen to BAI here?
I listen to BAI, but because I was at the time in the area, I had to commute to the Silicon Valley every day, so I had like this whole hour of like KPFA indoctrination every morning, so it was a much more stronger tie than now. I don't wake up early enough to listen to
it. Also may be a question, and how old were you then? How old are you now?
How old? Oh, this was like 2 years ago.
Okay, so not that much difference, but I mean, there's higher social plasticity for people in their early 20s than for people in their late 30s. Very often those effects are in part because of the flexibility you have to take advantage of social opportunities which tends to change as people get older.
And I also had my group of friends were much more in tune into those activities than the group of friends that I have now. Mm-hmm. But I immediately came to New York and looked for the Pacifica Radio Station to kind of
have plug that, into that.
Have that source of information. Right.
My sense is the BAI doesn't create as much of that.
That's what I was questioning and kind of looking online to find out. I know that within the Harlem community they have a lot of activities, but I've never tuned into that. I mean, I don't go farther than just listen to it.
They used to have this crafts fair. I know because my mom used to go when I was growing up. It was like really big. Every Christmas was this massive crafts fair, and it would actually pull people from like all around the Northeast, like in terms of crafts people. And I don't know how much the audience came from BAI or if they just sponsored it. But it, I mean, it was definitely this interesting social space going on. It was large. They did it at Columbia University. And then at some point when they lost their physical space, it started to fall apart.
And that's one of the things that we started to question, like, is this word of mouth, or is the center of this information that creates this subgroups and communities word of mouth, or is it because of the radio station? And that was just my observation, that when I started to tune into these activities back in the Bay Area, it was mainly because they reported, if I didn't go to the activity, they would still report back and talk about the events or whatever.
It's interesting to look at what feeds what. So, for example, they had this massive crafts fair. If you've never listened to BAI, but you're familiar with this crafts fair, do they draw members from events that they have? You know, which is kind of odd because they have this huge, powerful transmitter that broadcasts to everybody who wants to tune into that particular channel.
What was the important word in that sentence?
Say again.
What was the important word in that
broadcast.
Sentence? No, wants.
Oh, wants.
they broadcast to everybody who wants to tune in.
It's much more difficult to discover radio in a way, unless it's microformat radio that you come across as you're dialing around in your car.
Right.
Whereas something that's big and on the city street, there's more accidental discovery. You know, different limits of the population. Neither is a perfect strategy, but. Right, broadcast versus the other kinds of things, right? And these things tend to be ecosystems. In fact, you can almost never find something which is purely causal. X caused people to do Y, but you know, Y didn't cause anybody to do X. Right.
There was a podcast now, which makes it more accessible.
Who was podcasting now?
This radio station that we
I'll just get into the different tools that they use.
Yeah.
Podcasting and internet radio are a lot more ubiquitous. Allows people that are from, because that's kind of some of the questions I asked her, you know, when she said she was attending these groups, you know, whether or not it was the radio broadcast that was bringing people together, or if it was the people that were involved with the group that were going word of mouth, you know, trying to get people to come out, which was a stronger pull. And also the fact that, you know, when you have something like internet radio, it's not really as dependent on a broadcast time. You know, they target it towards commuters, and there's still a lot of people that kind of miss out on that, but now that there's other methods of transferring the information, it's you get a wider audience. The other things we talked about are tools and actually just the fund drives, and you know, that's really a tool to kind of increase membership or to maintain a membership, make sure that you're a part of something. And a lot of the time with that, they send out like a newsletter, you know, your promising newsletter to get with that. And that's one of the features of the membership that they have. The website where a lot of the news articles can kind of branch out from there, because a lot of the time they'll say, well, you know, you want to find out more information about something, go to the website.
Is that true of all three of these levels?
I don't think so. I'm not sure.
Definitely NPR and Pacific Radio News.
Use the website to do deeper.
Use more NPR because Pacifica Radio, some of the local websites are really rudimentary, not as robust as NPR.
And the little radio station, you know, out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, doesn't. I mean, they don't necessarily produce news; they buy their news from Pacifica, for example, from other news sources. So, in terms of using the website in that regard, I don't think.
What do they produce?
Well, I think very much they produce community, if you want to look at it that way, because everybody who works there, with the exception of the station manager and his assistant, are volunteers. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets paid to do anything, and yet you can't get a DJ spot. Like if you you could just go in and say, "Will you put me on the air?" And you know, you can set up a tape or go do you know, go meet with people, whatever. It's impossible to get a spot. And I think what it does is, and they're very open about what it is that they'll allow to be broadcast. I mean, you know, the format of what it is that it's basically radio without format. Or it's, the format is so open that you can literally play anything. I mean, I've heard, like, you know, the best of, like, 50s, you know, doo-wop all the way through, you know. I wish I could remember this guy's name. He moved out to... moved out to California, but he used to do, like, you know, the local punk and metal scene, which doesn't even exist anymore, you know what I mean? But he was a part of it. A friend, his name was Fran something or other. He's not, you know, but he was a part of it back in the day, and he still, you know, pulls out his old 45 someday, so it's blah, blah, blah.
Where do they get their financing from? Is it all?
Well, it's all membership driven, and one of the big differences between, like, the similarities between Pacifica and PKN is that they don't accept corporate. Whereas NPR does accept corporate sponsorship, and I think one of the big kind of attractions is that you know, you can actually be a part of something that is fully independent, and therefore is judged to be unbiased in what it's reporting and in, you know, what its mission is and where it stands.
Does it issues. Stem off of like a college in any way? Or
it actually broadcasts from what I guess used to be in some form, still it is, University of Richmond. And I say it that way because the university was actually, you know, bought. It was sold, and then someone else bought it. And so there was like a transformation. But it still broadcasts from whatever form the university is in now. Although it's not actually college radio. It just uses the transformation.
It's a lot. Like, there's one that's broadcast in New York called FMU. It's out of East Orange, New Jersey, actually. It's very similar. And they... I think it was a Jesuit school, but it had nothing to do with the school. And at some point, the school cut them off, and they like went 100% to the listeners. I think they, I'm pretty sure they claimed that they were the only 100% listener supported. Like, that was their absolute only source of revenue.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it was true or not.
It's the exact same thing. Like, yeah. They claim that you know, the radio station is not going to run unless the people who listen to it.
And they had a real community,
like whatever, you know, whatever it is that you give.
I don't know how much is left, but they had a massive community too. Like, if you had a bumper sticker, a T-shirt, or something,
it's
like,
still really
cool. Huge. I know they're on. Yeah, they have a lot of web stuff too.
They have two transmitters.
So PKN buys their stuff from Pacifica
and other sources.
And other sources, right? But buys, and then everything else is free. Why do they exist? What advantage is it that radio confers? And why does? Why are people listening to PKN?
I think in general, or at least from my personal perspective, my personal standpoint, it's backlash. You know, mm-hmm. I just can't stand to listen to regular corporate radio. Mm-hmm.
So what is crazy? So what is podcast?
I mean, I was once again the reason she listened to it was because it's not corporate sponsored. Mm-hmm. They can touch upon issues that other stations wouldn't touch upon. So it gives you kind of an alternative view of things. You know, it's kind of forced into that structure where it has to accept.
The thing is, their alternative view is bought elsewhere. They're not actually, they're an outlet for that, but they're not actually.
They're not actually.
Well, David, the one you're talking about deals with, I mean, they have a lot more radio.
What is it about
the music? They play a lot more music.
They play a lot more music, so it's.
What is it about the medium of radio that ties to local value?
Well, broadcasts over over a particular range.
Right. So it's the medium is inherently tied to geography. So what does podcasting mean for that?
Well, I mean, obviously you can broadcast to everybody now, or anybody who wants to tune in, you know, on your own recording. I think it increases the potential for membership, obviously.
Right, we'll play that out. Keep going.
Yeah.
Oh, well. On a sideline, I thought it was interesting when you started bringing up the free radio, the non-for-profit radio groups. I was really thinking you were going to talk about whoever's behind the group. And I never really thought about radio listeners as members and the radio listeners.
It's right.
And in a sense, the podcast takes kind of, because in a certain sense, you identify yourself and you make a move and it's mm-hmm. recordable and you know how much people downloaded the podcast, etc. Then it becomes kind of more an active right. gesture than just tuning on to a radio station.
What's the risk to PKN from podcasting?
Well, I mean, you could potentially start to deteriorate your core group of the people who transmit to the right, you know, tune into the right to transmit the signal, and the community that they
wired around the radio station. If it really picked up, I think you could.
Okay,
because the one big advantage of a podcast, I think, is that I'm not limited to a certain time in which I need to listen to it. Maybe 3 in the morning is the best time for me. Sure. You know, and then I can listen to it at that time.
And that increases autonomy. But if you increase autonomy, what do you decrease? Nah, I mean, fun driving, yeah, is part of it, but really, just the basic tension of the class. If you increase people's personal freedom, what are you decreasing?
Social coherence.
So you can absolutely switch to podcasting as a valuable change when your goal is counting individual listeners.
I don't think the more active participants are necessarily limited to podcasting either, because it definitely ties in with the fact that there is broadcasting on the radio.
Right.
But people get, and I guess this would be an argument for it, is that when you listen to a radio program, sometimes they ask for feedback. You can either call in by phone, or you can send an email, or you can probably discuss it, assuming they have like a chat board or something set up there. Mm-hmm. And that becomes programming in itself. And I guess there are cases, I've heard podcasts where people, you know, will feedback to things, they'll go into the mailbox or the mailbag and read into that.
Thanks.
There's also a much higher entry. Radio's strength is read accessibility in the class.
Right, especially in a place like Bridge.
Well, it's funny. There's. I thought you were about to say exactly the opposite, because there's a lower barrier to entry to producing. There's a higher barrier to entry to consuming. So there are many more producers chasing fewer earballs, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, in terms of podcasting, comparing podcasting to radio, there's many more producers and fewer consumers right now.
It's not an absolute in terms of barrier to entry as a listener, though it's actually much lower if you're not inside a geographic range, right? So.
Right. But if you are not targeting a particular source of content, but you want to listen to the radio, more people in this country can listen to the radio than can listen to a podcast. There are some technological barriers there, but there's fairly large barriers of use and familiarity. Most people's computers still don't function terribly well as audio playback devices. But there's still something here about, I mean, when you were trying to tell a story about Pacifica, but you said KPFA, so you ended up actually talking about the local radio station. There's something about radio being tied to literally just how far can the transmitter get that automatically involves people in a geographic area. And podcasting subdivides that. When everybody starts tuning into podcasts based on their personal interests, rather than being limited to as an accident, but a happy accident, only listening to those things that are also being listened to by people in your area, you lose the potential for social capital. Because suddenly going to local events and reporting on them in the context of a podcast makes much less sense.
But I think that a lot of our observations were that podcasting is something that they recently started to implement as part of their tools, right? We discussed that a lot of the strength is the fact that they're nonprofit and that people, a lot of the people who are listeners, who are active listeners, my perception is that they also donate.
Sure.
And then there's a sense of membership.
Right.
So podcasting wasn't so much, I mean, it's something that we can discuss, but it wasn't something that we were.
I'm not proposing podcasting today. All I'm suggesting is play out over time for radio the loss of geographic constraint, it's certainly a win for the ecosystem when you're counting atomized listeners, but it greatly reduces the possibility of accidental communal formation of the sort that KPFA did. Because when I'm podcasting, let's say I have I'm the happiest podcaster alive, I have 100,000 listeners. They're not going to be near me. They're going to be tuning into themes rather than areas. And the loss of geographic proximity as an accidental byproduct of radio is going to be a really fairly profound shift.
Geography is time, too. They're not giving even time or space.
Oh, that's right. The synchronized time is maybe some... Right, because if I listen to something 2 weeks after the event happened, I'm suddenly much less.
I think I agree with the fact that, when you take it into a podcasting context, you're taking it outside of the limitations of time,
right.
And then some of the events that are mentioned kind of lose a little bit of relevance. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, you pointed out that, you know, podcasts are generally categorized according to specificity.
Yeah. Theme, yeah, themes but, and interest, right.
So, for instance, like, don't, I mean, you could almost categorize something according to a geographic area. You could say, my podcast is going to be about events in, you know, Ann Arbor, Michigan, or something, or within the Manhattan area that revolve around maybe a certain technology or something. In which that's one of the things that I'm kind of wondering is, even though it's you know, it's available for anybody to download it at their own pace, are people getting so addicted to podcasts that, you know, maybe they're recognizing it as a source for something, and then they're constantly tuning in or downloading it, listening to it, to try to find out like when the next event is or something like that. So.
Yeah, podcasts have a very, like, the only listeners are deliberate. They're 100% deliberate listeners, whereas the radio has this sort of semi-deliberate. You can stumble on it, or it's the worst, you know, the best of all the options, even though it's not what you're into, and that creates a different kind of cohesion, and it's tied to geography as well, obviously.
Right. So it's, and it may be that there's a happy medium, that radio will take such a long time for radio to phase out, because it is a pretty significant piece of infrastructure, that for the next decade or so, radio will get to ride both
trends. But it may be that the loss of geographic limitation actually makes radio a producer of less social capital and more autonomous behavior.
But then there's also satellite radio is in there too,
right? Which is necessarily non-local for different reasons than podcasts, but
it seems to be effective in creating social capital, something like Thom Hartmann or something. It's like you have people really Thom Hartmann, people subscribing to these services. You know, I don't know. Did Howard Stern switch yet, or is he gonna?
He signed a contract switch. I don't think he started broadcasting. He's on Sirius, I guess.
I would think that in the term of sharing information or geographical specified information, if we're on the platform on the web, there would be better mediums than media than audio for that. And an interesting thing that if we're speaking about the social capital. There's a certain in the online and offline radio station in Israel that I did the website for, and I hear about a lot of Israelis that listen to it here. Now, the language is one reason, but there isn't much talking in this station. It's mainly music, and music is most of the music is international. But it is a part of the station.
What's the station? 106 FM. Well, I mean, what's the name of the station?
It's an independent station. It's affiliated with a certain school, and so language can maintain a social capital, and unless it's English.
Right. Right, this is much better, right? Well, except if you have, if English is your language and you're living in China, then English maintains social capital. So it's right, the podcasting is actually better at preserving a diaspora. It's not great at creating social capital de novo from a geographically small group, but it is good at preserving social capital among a diaspora. Yeah, I used to be in the sort of, the internet is also going to make us all sort of stateless global actors. Until I was teaching at Hunter, I observed that my Taiwanese students were all reading the daily newspaper from Taiwan, and I realized this is a degree of reach back that immigrants and travelers have never previously enjoyed. Right. So it's not a one-way, it's certainly not a one-way effect, but it is worth looking at sort of, if you play out the podcasting revolution, if you assume it is a revolution, sort of what does that do? What does that do to radio?
Yeah, there's something about the live, though, I think, that binds a community. I'm not sure how that one is broadcasted, and if they're listening to it online, it's still kind of live, or almost. And your feeling of belonging to a group is different than pre-recorded that you can listen to.
can't listen to a baseball game on a podcast.
Right, right. No, Karen Merriman, who's a student here a few years ago, did a great paper on an IRC channel that was tuned into a radio station that broadcasts sort of pan Middle Eastern music, and the chat channel was occupied by both Israelis and Palestinians, and it provided this sort of non-physical, relatively neutral space where they could listen to music, and periodically they would stage dance parties in which they would kind of be typing in, you know, oh, I love this song, it makes me want to dance, and then they would just type in all slashes and then all slashes the other way like they were doing the wave. And there is something, and it wasn't just the liveness of it, although, and there's two aspects to live. There is the thing that's coming out of the radio is happening now, so that's reporting on disasters and sports and so forth. But there's another aspect of live, which is as I'm listening to it, other people are listening to it. So there's both real time, but there's also synchronization, and you can actually imagine synchronization, but time shift. There hasn't been a lot of experimentation with that because it happens on the server, not on the client. But it's an area still for exploration and audio.
It's interesting, especially with radio, because radio has this time frame of wherever a broadcast from. But on that specific example, it's interesting because I would listen to it when I know people in Israel have slipped, but still they are talking to you, and you are the listener.
And they're aware of all the people that they're broadcasting abroad, and that would be interesting. It's kind of like a 24-hour station that has different listeners for different people.
And it was very interesting when we were working on a shift in the playlist, and they were trying to distinguish time frames. And then, well, what about all our listeners abroad? And it was they wanted because they are allowed to broadcast as a radio station only in Tel Aviv. And actually, when I lived in Tel Aviv, I would listen to them through the web because it had better reception. So in Israel. In Israel, they have a lot of reception online, and in the world, it shifts all the way that it works.
There's lots and lots of stuff to play with the social effects of time. I'm reminded of Jim Baumbach, who was one of the people on Echo that I was talking about earlier, one of the sort of core group of Echo, and he founded a group called Zulu. And the motto of Zulu was a less restful alternative to sleep. And it was a conversation that was only accessible between 11 p.m. and 7 a.m. It would otherwise shut down. And he actually coded it so that it would read the timestamp of the incoming user and only let you post when it was late at night your time. So it wasn't the whole group of Zulu users, because there were some people distributed everywhere, could never get together. But there was a degree to which everyone was talking, having sort of late night thoughts. And that gave the place a very particular flavor. So the degree of plasticity we have over time shifting is only just, the surface has only just been scratched. We've been through four of the groups now, and I think you should start to be able to see some connections for everybody except the radio group. Are you seeing any patterns in the radio group that have come up in other groups that we've talked about or that you looked at? Anything strike you similar between
the scale?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So
same problem that we talked about the other podcast.
Right.
Sense of membership or belonging.
Mm-hmm. Right. What exactly the total problematic? What does it mean to be a member? And why do they give you a tote bag? Right, last thing in your world you need, cheapest piece of swag ever. Why do they give you a tote bag when you give money to NPR? As compared to other equally cheap pieces of swag.
Because it's an advertisement.
It's
an advertisement. T-shirts, tote bags. Although, I don't know where the mugs come in, really.
But
worse. Mugs you bring to work. You don't drink out of these at home.
More so, I mean, there's two different ways to think about advertising. Are you advertising a radio station, or are you advertising yourself as a member?
Both.
And it's both.
Yeah. It's both, right.
Right, cut back to give you away. So they're actually trying to leverage the members to be sort of at them. The other pattern.
Why do they make them so ugly then?
Yeah, that's a different problem. it's actually a declaration of your love, right? I love NPR so much that I'm willing to schlep this ugly tote bag around. The other pattern that strikes me as similar is the tension between local and global that Upgrade has, right? What does Pacifica mean and what does KPFA mean? And Pacifica has been riven in the past by different radio stations adopting policies that are or are not suitable from the point of view of the parent organization. So very much like Upgrade, when you start to get into these levels of clustering and supervening brands, you start getting tension about sort of who you're bringing under your tent. Okay, last group, Nurit, Ryan, and Michael. Meetup.
So we chose meetup.com, but more specifically a specific dining out meetup group within the meetup structure to analyze. And so we found this by going on Craigslist activities section. And found a Vietnamese dining out group that was advertised there and followed the link through, and it was actually to a meetup.
Had you intended to go to meetup, or did you start with Craigslist and end up on meetup?
Started with Craigslist and went in and like, oh, right, let's go eat Vietnamese food and click on that, and it takes you to meetup. So we saw that there was an event this Friday, and we were like, well, we can go join the Vietnamese dining out meetup group and go to the event. So we'll fly over this, but we all joined the group. But once you join the group, you realize you find out where the event is, and the event is closed. Only 30 people can go to the event. And this kind of goes back to the problem we were talking about Upgrade at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But the total group membership is 166. So, 172. So, and this is interesting, in just the past week since we've decided to all join, members keep growing, but once you get in, you realize you can't go to the event. So, it kind of creates a...
The recruiting works, like, incredibly well, and then all the tools of this group are made towards recruiting more, but there's very little information about what anything is. Like, the number of steps that I went through in joining as a member, where I was able to invite other people without even knowing what it was, I probably had like 6 opportunities to send stuff out, and like forced through screens to send emails to somebody to get them to join as well. But the problem is that this group is so geared to recruiting that they can't function.
Where was the ad on Craigslist? Was it like Misconnections or something? Like,
no, it was in Activities. I know.
Yes. You're assuming that they only read Misconnections.
What else do people read?
And to add to what Michael is saying, it's not only that through the process to get all these emails and the policy to promote it anymore, they have a promote link on the website.
On the meetup website.
Yeah, so it sends you back to Craigslist, so you can post over meetings, or you can suggest a meeting and then post it on Craigslist or another. You can make flyers, you can make cards, you can directly invite friends. So there's a whole page just for promoting it even more. But it's really frustrating. There's another interesting thing about it, that it has what I like to call the Amazon effect. Once you go to a member's page, it gives you all of these other meetup members, and that's really funny. So it seems like Ryan was doing a lot of research about that a lot of the people that are in these meetup groups are also members of other meetup groups.
Two
or more. If they're a member of this, they're at least a member of two or more other groups.
What question has already come up today along those same lines for a different group?
I'm asking questions about the people. Like,
right. But the question you just came up in a different context. What other group had exactly that question? Don't you volunteer. I know you know. I just want to see if anybody else is paying attention.
What you
The question of whether or not a member in one group is likely to be a member of another group.
SourceForge,
right. Mm-hmm. Same issue with SourceForge. And right, you start to see out of seemingly event-oriented stuff in a star topology, you start to see a social structure underneath it where you can trace directed links. That's interesting. How long had the event closed before you joined?
I think the last person, the data, the only thing that I could figure that out would be somebody joined October 15th, and they are going to dinner with the
inside, right.
But there is the loophole is keep looking, somebody may drop out from the event tonight, and then I can still go.
Right.
But what's also interesting is they don't tell you where the event is unless you're in those 30 people.
Right.
But I was able to, there's a voting section, polling, and so everybody can poll where this is the anniversary week, the 1 year anniversary of the group. So people.
And it's just Vietnamese, or it's dining around?
No, just Vietnamese. And it started in just Chinatown, now they moved on to all corners of New York, they call it. There was one originator of the group, this Vietnamese Canadian man, and now they're
out to Flushing.
So, but the one thing was there's a polling section where they were like, which of the restaurants do we want to celebrate our anniversary in? And they had, you could click on one of three. So, feasibly, we could go crash it.
Just SMS each other, the three of you check each restaurant.
Right.
You could probably call for a reservation at 30, too.
Also, there was
That's right. Is the party 30 yet?
Yeah.
So we could crash. I mean, restaurant. We can still let it up.
There was another issue that to one of the meetings we thought we would be able to go. Brian said that he couldn't go. What if he sent everybody an email saying that he cannot make it on Friday, he's going to make it on Saturday, so people that can make it on Friday will come on Saturday.
Nobody responded to me. But I did. My introduction was like, I can't make the Friday, but who wants to go on Saturday?
And no one responded?
And not yet, no.
When did you send that?
Yesterday.
Mm-hmm. So,
that's a good question.
Yeah, we haven't been able to get into the level to understand how they organize and decide on what. We're really hoping we're going off the Vietnamese tonight.
Yeah. It's very disappointing, especially because there's all these levels of expectation and recruitment, and then once you go to the events and you feel, and also the event is actually, we just understood that the section of time, but on the 28th.
No, I think it's tonight. They're
waiting
tonight.
There's something weird.
Are you sure it's not like a cult or something?
Yeah.
like real estate.
Right, it does have that sort of.
Yeah, like you get lots of
credit
card
bills.
Am I not being accepted to this wealthy privilege? Do you feel like you don't want to be part of this group again?
Don't need members.
Or you just want to be, like, are you more encouraged to keep on trying?
It's more like we were asking ourselves, how can we really observe this group? Mm-hmm. We could observe it only by joining them and actually going to all of these dining sessions. And if we won't be able to do it, then the question is what are the means to actually observe that group mm-hmm. and learn it? And they make it really difficult for us to do it. It's only to go and read articles about them or.
If you like this kind of channel of communication, to look for some other meetup group. Because this one seems to have been too successful and it's for itself, you know. And then it's like, if you look at the
wouldn't it really interesting to crash it though?
70 and just 30. Your question of is it discouraging? Yeah, I mean, for us and just what we're doing here, I want to move on and find something that will be.
It's not just that. I mean, obviously, in Noreen's voice, there was also some real emotional disappointment. Not just research frustration, but like, I'd actually kind of gotten psyched to go have some. Yeah.
The question is, why are they still promoting the growth of the group when the event scheduled this week was full? maybe there's something that blocks that, and that's where I guess the technology.
So why are they doing that?
Maybe they themselves are encouraged by the fact that others can be at the beginning.
It feels like a popularity club.
Vietnamese restaurants.
I think, like, I was thinking about it, is like in the, I don't know if it's still around, it probably is, I think I mentioned it before, about the Bernardo's list that was around in, like, late 90s.
It's still around, believe it or not.
It's still around?
Yeah,
wow.
It's still around.
So it's like, everybody wanted to join the list. Like, the only way you could join at the beginning is if it was, if you were in the loop of, like, internet development something. And it was like, when I joined, there were like 2,000 members. I don't know how many are now. But so it was not that big back then. And you knew you were not going to get into every single event. First of all, you didn't have time to do it. And then it would be, you would need to RSVP. And then you would have to try several times before you could actually go to one of the events. But then people wanted to go. And then more people kept signing in, even though it was almost impossible to go to any of the events. So because once you RSVP, and if you were within those first 30 people, mm-hmm. then you get an email with a password. Mm-hmm. And then you could go to this event, and then it was going to be in a lounge, in a closed, it was like before they would open to the public, and then you go to this lounge, it was closed, and then you wouldn't have a code, or the password, whatever, you would not be let in. But then that build this intensity of like, I want to be part of this. I want to be into this private circle.
There is this experiment called the bump list.
Oh, yes.
And actually, the guy who did it, Jonah Brooker-Cohen, is an IT guy. And it's an artwork, which is a mailing list, which can have only 6 people at one time. So you need to, every time you subscribe a post, you are bumping the 6th person. So it's a kind of a loop, and people are like in a craze about like, what am I missing? I was in the middle of a conversation, and it keeps on going on. Like, I tried it a couple of times, and especially I wrote some very, you know, I was speaking about issues that people would like to cling to, and then like. People kept on subscribing again, and it's a very and there is no archive of this list, not public in any way. So it's a kind of something that it
feels tension.
It works in a way against the dynamic of a mailing list, but in a way it specifies a certain demand. A certain characteristic of this medium.
But
I'm just wondering, like, what is the success of such a group? Is it the number of people? I mean, especially the one that you're dealing with. Is it the number of people that the more it grows, that it's a proof or a feedback that this is a successful group, or is it in the meeting, especially since it's around food and the whole social interaction is around that specific meeting. So it brings a lot of questions around it. I'm very suspicious about that.
What would happen if they did one Friday night and one Saturday night dinner? If they'd taken Ryan's suggestion and gone there?
It would divide the group, and then the cool people would, like...
What would the people on Saturday night be wondering?
What happened on Friday?
I was just about to ask. It's meetup.com. What's stopping you guys from starting a Vietnamese food dining group of your own?
Well, that's what I was thinking. There's enough overflow that we're doing feedback, so we should come up with another one separately.
So who's the driver of the group? Anybody can just host
or
create a group?
I'm not sure. I think that's what we have to do to find out. So
in meetup itself?
As well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why everyone belongs to so many groups, though, because can't go to Vietnamese this week, you can go to Italian.
Well, yeah. Are you guys still asking why it's so limited? Can you fit 173 people in a small Vietnamese restaurant?
No, but the question wasn't why it's so limited. The question is why are they still recruited, which is a different kind of question. Knowing the limitations, as the group does, where does the drive for recruitment come from? And we brought up a couple of answers, but there's one still, and Noah's...
And what do you think is a website?
Yeah, I think
it's just 30 people per event.
I think that the problem is just that it's not the group isn't the strength that went and found the tools to use to recruit it. It's that the tools went and created a group, and they're automated, and so it doesn't drive anything real in what people want, but it's sort of it kind of is this thing of itself.
Well, it drives something real, it scales what you want. But it may, because my guess is that those auto-subscribe screens are effectively driven by Meetup with almost no plasticity of choice on the part of you or the founders of the group. And that Meetup, particularly if members belong to two or more Meetups, Meetup benefits enormously from every bit of recruiting, even if it's at the expense of this individual group.
Does Meetup have a business model yet?
What's that?
Do they have a business model yet?
They do, and this is it. The business model is that users pay to belong to groups over time, and they generate, they treat the group as a unit and generate revenue from the unit. Their old business model was Howard Dean would pay, which got them through most of 2003 and much of 2004. But it turns out the political style of organization encouraged by Meetup wasn't all that effective for getting votes. So politicians lost interest, understandably.
So will you pay if you're a member of the group for more than 6 months or something? Or
no, the group pays. So it can be syndicated in any way. The leader can pay and get the social capital. The core group can pay to support it for everybody else, or you can pass the hat. But there's no, for an individual user, there's no requirement to pay. It's just the group has to come up with the money. And the leader of the group, not the members, are the ones who are on the hook for that.
Well, this reminds me a little bit, maybe not really relevant, but it reminds me of how the luxury market works, because it sets the whole thing. It's like you buy a very expensive product, and then you become automatically a member of this closet group.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all these counterfeit products sold in Canal Street and all over the world. And a lot of times, like these big companies don't really do much to stop that, because that increases the price of the
desirability of it.
And then it allows for all the people that cannot really afford the top end products to still feel they belong to our group.
Well, sometimes they feed it.
Yeah. Yesterday, Mo, in the thing about Networks Class, Mo Centrin gave a talk on the spread of, he presented his midterm, on the spread of cracked keys for software. And the conversation came up around people get used to the tools in school, which they're using in cracked formats, and they suddenly go into the world of work and they have to buy them. And so there is this weird dynamic between breaking intellectual property law, and yet that's made Microsoft Word, you know,
be what it is.
Right, exactly. The dominant format. All right, well, that's great. I know that it's I would discourage you all from switching Meetup groups. I'd either crash it if you're game, or if not, then at least see what you can find out in using the group as people who are interested in the themes and are now members and whatever that means, but don't actually get to go to the event. Like, find out what you can glean on Sunday morning or Saturday morning or whatever from this thing tonight. And then, yeah, if you're willing.
See if they cross-post on Chowhound or something, too.
Right.
Yeah.
See if it, because it may be.
Well, there's a featured comments sidebar mm-hmm. on the Meetup thing, and people write their comments of the last few. And mm-hmm. One was notably funny. She was like, I had a great time, except for there was one member of the group that obviously didn't like ethnic cuisine or something. Mm-hmm. And kind of like, so I don't know why she was there. So it'd almost be funny to
right.
trace that back.
Right. Oh, that's interesting.
I think this whole issue is coming back to something that we spoke about, which was the rules for losing.
Right. Under what circumstances would you still be a member of this group, since your initial experience is pretty lousy?
And an interesting question: can Meetup as a platform come up with a future?
Did you mention Howard Dean and Meetup?
Yes.
What's your relationship with this?
Howard Dean, in January of 2003, so long before the election, almost 2 years before the election, Howard Dean staged a meetup. Howard Dean supporters in New York staged a meetup on a little restaurant over in Nolita, and 300 people showed up. And when the organizers got wind of that, they called Dean in Vermont, who at that time didn't have two nickels to rub together, and they said, you ought to get on a plane and come down here if you can. And he came down, and he was a rock star. And, I mean, this was January, and people were standing in the streets because they couldn't get in this little restaurant that agreed to host this thing. And so Meetup became one of their tools of choice for coordinating local activities and for doing fundraisers and for doing letter writing and so forth. And one of the things the politicians have always noticed, if you get people in a room, they're more willing to send letters or call people because the social capital of the room increases their willingness to reach out in ways that they don't individually. So Meetup was one of the core organizing tools, the other being Dean Space, the Drew Powell instantiation, or Drew Powell, I don't know even how to pronounce that. Well, I haven't seen it written. The Drew Powell instantiation that they built to run the sort of Dean weblog.
But that came afterwards, right?
Right. But so those are the Meetup was the first, and then Dean Space was later that year. Zach Rosen and Zephyr Teachout's thing.
So who finds out about Meetup to go to?
Well, so it's stuff like Craigslist. In this case, it was you would recruit, but then you would use Meetup as the coordinating tool. So a little bit like in the earliest presentation about Upgrade. Right, there was an artist who cared enough to present both her own work and to advertise the existence of this thing. A lot of the Deaniacs, so-called, use Meetup to try and get local groups to coalesce and then do fundraising and so forth. So it was. And for a while, Dean was paying Meetup for additional, essentially, tool development. Right, Meetup would build things on behalf of the politicians. And at one point, I think, There certainly was a Bush one. Dean, Kerry, and what was that guy's name? General Clark and Wes Clark all had Meetup groups, and that was their principal source of funding.
And
along
the same line of question for search words, what are the tools that Meetup gives groups that make it worthy of investing in the world?
Well, this is the big question. This is what they're wrestling with now. The principal tool is like SourceForge. It's a site for aggregation, right? So it's easier for people to find than if each of those little groups was out dispersed. More recently, they've been trying to put tools in the hands of members for things like file upload galleries, BBSs, and they're moving towards a system where they're actually going to start collecting and managing funds on behalf of the members, so that if a group has a goal that actually requires raising and dispersing funds, Meetup can potentially act like a kind of group instantiation of PayPal. So it's still very much a work in progress, but that's the question you just asked is the question, which is, you know, what's better about SourceForge than CVS plus FTP plus PHPBB? Meetup has exactly the same problems for social coordination. So let me talk about the second half of this assignment.
Can I have one question before? How are our groups chosen? Like the groups of three?
I think I just went down a list I had and I wrote ABCDE, ABCDE, ABCDE. I don't, why? Did it seem like there was?
I was just wondering.
I think I just had a good list and I wrote letters next to them. No, I didn't assume that there would be. I mean, the group seems diverse enough that I wasn't too worried that it was going to be narrow if it got shuffled. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to answer these three questions. I want to read from one of those. You've got the extra. Okay, great.
So this is due front next Friday.
Yeah. So
it's not the 24th.
What's that?
It's not up till the 24th, mm-hmm. Friday.
What's today?
21st.
Oh.
The 23rd is Sunday.
That's odd. My fault. I don't know why I...
So is it
what is next Friday?
28th.
October 28th.
Is the paper due individually?
Next week, yes. So the paper is to be done individually, which is to say I'm interested in your personal observations, and I presume that each of you will have had things that you've observed that you find especially interesting. So rather than making you represent as a group some group set of characteristics, because I know that you're
I mean, I think as with the very first example, you use Upgrade, you know Upgrade, you were introduced to Upgrade. I want a paper written from your personal view and around your personal interests. Yes.
The paper is due next week, not
yes.
the week after.
Yes.
Because
it was
written
differently.
So, yes.
Is that right?
Because one of the issues that we were actually, should we change our group because of that?
I think as with the previous paper, I'm certainly willing to. Would it make more sense for me to make this in 2 weeks?
Because we have an upgrade session next Thursday, and that
okay.
would be one night before
the. Fine. So I'll figure out the new day, and we'll say 2 weeks. You're welcome to continue the conversation in groups. It sounds like it's fruitful. I'd encourage you to do that. I'm going to ask you to send me these documents in electronic form, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to take your document and I'm going to give it to the other two group members to ask for their comments. The comments won't have anything to do with my comments. I'll do those separately. But I think it will be interesting for you all, after being in a group situation, to see what the individual reactions are as well. So your paper will effectively have three readers, which is me plus the other two people who've looked at the same situation. And you'll get a chance to see the group you're talking about modeled from two other points of view as well.
This is in
2 weeks? This is in 2 weeks.
November 4th.
November 4th. Unless we did it November 4th. And the questions I am asking are largely the questions we've just discussed here, with the one addition of imagine making a change. In some cases, you can imagine the change as simply being, I'm going to take a current effect that I see and I'm going to play it out in the future, right? What is the effect on the game group of the continuing swirl around the world of IM and AIM locking them out or not locking them out? So you can imagine what happens if AOL opens up. Does the need for game reduce or increase, right? You can ask, what does podcasting do to radio? What does the increasing international station do to Upgrade and so forth? Or you can imagine a kind of operational change, analogous to what we did in the last paper, which is, now I'm going to assume that the game group is operating in-game. They're going to abandon the IRC channel in favor of trying to keep a game channel up all the time. Or I'm going to imagine that radio is going to move towards more explicitly wants to drive more local interaction. What could it do? So you can either change the tool or the goal. But imagine making a change to the environment, whether it's something that's already happening or playing out, or something that you're imagining coming in. And speculate as to what you think would happen, including possible downsides. Right? As with the conversation around podcasting, which is better for social capital among diasporas, but worse for social capital among locally congregated groups. So find some of those kinds of effects. And I'll leave you with that. I want to talk briefly about two of the... I've set a new rule for myself. If we don't get through, what's that? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Oh, I didn't realize you were doing me and yours. I think. I've set a new rule for myself, which is if we don't get through the readings, I'm not going to assign a new one for next week. So now we'll set aside internet paradox for a moment. But I want to talk about two more colloquial readings, Lucasfilm's Habitat and Turbo Ted. Let's start with Lucasfilm's Habitat. If you had to design a game tomorrow, a massively multiplayer game,
I wouldn't do it.
What's that?
I wouldn't do it.
You wouldn't do it. All right, you'd say no. And you had this as your principal guide. What would you do? What would you try and do, and what would you try and avoid?
Make it organic, so it grows at the dimensions, and give freedom to the user to be able to develop parts that you would not necessarily be able to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's like, how do you divide yourself in 20,000?
And 20,000, as we know now, I mean, this was written over 10 years ago about an experiment that had happened a few years before. Mm-hmm. So 20,000 is now a tiny number compared to some of the universes we're seeing, like World of Warcraft and Star Wars galaxies. So yeah, the organic problems that you're mentioning are only worse since this.
But don't most of the new ones subdivide significantly into different servers?
Right, and how and why do they do that?
I think partly it's technological and partly it's social. You can't deal with a million people or 2 million people on the same server.
Right. So some of it is server load, but there's also another advantage to worlds or shards or what have you that they specifically mentioned in here, that they discovered in a world with 50 people.
Type of play and the
yeah.
sort of thing that you want to do.
That's like player versus player or player versus game going on, like whether people want to cooperate or kill each other.
But there was one specific scenario in here. I think it was the first story they told. And this paper obviously really switches gears when they go to telling the stories about designing something on behalf of the player base and having it fail. What was the class of failure?
They had the one with the store in the Muffin Man.
Okay, that was actually interesting. That, I'm thinking of a different one, but what was that story?
Well, they had tried to predict kind of how things would work in terms of the economy and goods, but users immediately found out, like overnight, users found out you could get something for basically like, you know, for less here and go pawn it across the street and earn like a buck or whatever it was in their currency. And so then the next morning, you know, they came in to check and see how the system and everything was running, and suddenly the economy was totally skewed and all these like multi-millionaires couldn't tell them how they found money.
They had some weird equivalent of like M1 in there.
T1 is what they call it.
Yeah,
T1.
Right.
M1 is the flow of liquid money in the economy. M2 is liquid money plus things like illiquid assets and so forth. And so they called their T1. They called their liquid money T1 as a joke. On.
So the more interesting thing was in like how you mitigate a problem with that, how you resolve it.
Yeah.
If they follow that
model. You have to keep it within the world environment. You can't break that.
Yeah.
That reality of things. Otherwise, you're just, you know, it's like the creators that you're cheating on you. Like.
And they had to go and beg the users to tell them what they were doing. I mean, it's the game had scaled, you know, it happens a lot in big code. It scaled beyond their own understanding. They couldn't solve it until they.
I've almost seen, like, just from the mini games that you see on sites, I play once and I'm like, you know, what's the big deal? When you see people with, like, hundreds of thousands of points as the high score, meaning they played for hours, it's almost like, it almost seems like a rule whenever you create these games that people, if they can find something to exploit, or they'll just take it to an extreme.
That is a rule, in fact.
It's like I have a friend who had an EverQuest character who sold it for $3,000, and I'm thinking,
wow.
It's a game. And he sold his, I forget, he sold his weapon for an enormous amount of money, too, and I'm thinking, you know, he's going to, you know, pays this.
If you're interested in those kinds of effects, there's a blog called Terra Nova. It's a group blog done by the stars of the sort of theoretical game world.
What's it called?
Terra Nova. And it was co-founded by Ted Castronova, who invented the discipline of foreign exchange using game currency, essentially tracking the value of in-game currency by watching eBay auctions. And he can actually see when the exchange rates are shifting between both different kinds of, between different kinds of game currency by watching the offline sale price. It's crazy what's going on in there. But the point earlier about having to beg the users, why? Right? They're on the damn server. I can shut them off if I want to.
Well, I didn't want to do, you know, they wanted to create a natural, quote-unquote.
But that just restates the problem. Why bother? Why bother creating a natural?
Well, because if they disrupt the game, then they're interrupting, they're breaking them out of the gameplay, and they don't want to do that. When you create this game, you create this, like, what is Hunziker call, like, the magic circle, right?
The death character, and then they get the gun back.
Yeah.
That's a pretty central
violation. And how did they do it? They did it two different ways, right? Once overnight and once in the morning.
Yeah.
What'd they do?
Well, the first time, the operator of the Qualcomm thing operator just contacted the guy directly and it said, I'm going to deactivate your account unless you give me back that gun. And then they put up a big fuss, and eventually they got really angry and they posted all kinds of stuff. And group of people got angry. But and then the other way was that they had a negotiation in a sense, and they had to like meet up and then pay them, and they had Death come into town and like, you know, buy his gun back.
And I mean, that to me in the story, I mean, there's a bunch of other things up here, but that story to me is really the, because on the theme of rules for losing, it looks like one of the ways that players were willing to participate in this game world is if the game world wasn't violated, if the implicit sense of the reality of the game wasn't violated by people coming in and behaving as if it's just a server and it's just data and you're going to move the data around.
But the interesting thing is how, like, yeah, why don't you just turn it off or delete the web on?
Right.
It's like part of a game of like respecting the rules,
right?
Like social rules, and which are like the same rules that we live with.
Yeah, and so one of the things is the developers got caught in their own social fact.
Yeah.
Right. They created a gun that they wanted people to invest some real sense of meaning in, and then when the people did, the developers found that the physical fact of the gun, the electronic fact of the gun, was trivial, but that the social fact of the gun was dispositive in the direction of having to negotiate with the users.
Well, that's like in games, it's a common thing is that people treat cheaters like they don't really like cheaters, but they cheaters like obey the rules of the game still in a way, and then you have spoil sports who like trying to break the rules of the game, and they're treated way worse, right? It's like you spoil sports destroying everyone's fun, whereas the cheater is kind of like not good, but like they're in there still, so you're like sort of deal
with. And what are griefers doing? Because they're not doing either of those things, but they're treated almost worst of all. Someone whose goal is just to cause grief in the system. What are they attacking? They're not attacking the hardware.
They're attacking the legitimacy of the game.
They're attacking this. What part of the system are they attacking? Because where does the grief happen? The grief doesn't happen on the machine.
It happens to the players.
Uh-huh. So what are they attacking? Right, they're attacking the social capital. The griefer's specific target is the social infrastructure of the game. Which it's the most frustrating problem. I heard Will Wright give an amazing speech on this for SimCity, The Sims rather. The amazing thing about griefers is that because almost nothing they do is reachable on system level terms, any set of rules you set up, the griefers will operate just inside. I have a 4-year-old who moves basically on the same principles. Whatever the rules are, he can touch them. And if you really restrict the rules, the game stops being fun. Yeah. So the griefers seem to be this kind of penumbral effect around in the gap between what you can do with technology and the kind of social effect that takes place in the game.
I was just going to ask, is there somebody who's done a lot of studies on this, or is there a formula for it? I just find it really interesting.
Yes.
The community site that I built, I had examples of that where I had a girl who, I had somebody who... was complaining about another person because of certain posts that they made, and that person didn't want to give up, and it's like you can't just omit their, it's like, so I think it's something that's like it's a characteristic of every, it's probably a characteristic of every game and every online community.
The answer is yes and no. There have been a lot of studies done. There isn't there isn't yet a cohesive theory of it. We are next semester, when I say we, I mean a loose group of people who've been thinking about these issues, me, Tom Coates, Mark Smith out at Microsoft, Liz Lawley up at RIT, are going to try to get, going to try and build what we're calling a pattern language for moderation, which is we're just going to try and write down all the ways that people have faced these problems. There are things like karma, there are things like formal membership, there are things like retroactive moderation and so forth. And we're going to start with just a list of all of the possible approaches in a sort of pattern language format, which is you break it down into smaller sections.
Like Chris Alexander.
Right, exactly. If we're successful, we're hoping that will become a palette for developers to think through these issues. Because they, as we know, social effects are often things you need to optimize for rather than solve. So that's one of the reasons that there's no magic formula, is that... they're highly sensitive to very particular changes. But there's one other thing. I was fishing for it, so I'll stop fishing and I'll just remind you of the story about the shards and worlds strategy in online games, which is they built this whole great adventure,
right?
And they handed it out to the players, and what happened?
5 minutes later, 8 hours later,
somebody solved it. And of course, at that moment, they realized if somebody solves it, nobody else can solve it. I mean, it's eerily analogous to the Vietnamese restaurant problem, which is, right, you've gone and taken the trouble to deploy this opportunity for a group of people that's too large to enjoy the opportunity you've deployed, and they suddenly realize that so their strategy is very much Ariel's strategy, which is make the world more open-endedly social and let people make their own fun, because that's the only way we can have this degree of design go across the system as a whole. And that's the kind of
guild-ish strategy of people on relatively simple game primitives building up the social structure. The other strategy, which is usually deployed in parallel, is build a world in which you have this kind of adventure and then fork that world 50 times so that you can multiply just by copying it to multiple servers the possibility of that adventure being had. And very often you get this weird rabbit hole characteristic in these games of everybody existing together in a social space and getting together in a tavern or what have you and deciding to go out and slay a dragon. And when you leave at some point, and you never feel it in the game, but it happens, you leave the world you were in and you foreclose the possibility that anybody who's back in the tavern can join you later. Because the software actually forks it so that you're having that experience uniquely and can't be intruded on. And that, this is why I was pushing so much on the, particularly for the upgrade thing. The issues of forking around scale are phenomenally complicated. And it's very hard to create forks that don't leave the users feeling bereft somehow, and yet dumping them into larger and larger scale systems also leaves them feeling upset. Right? I have an intuition that if there was Vietnamese on Friday and Saturday, or Vietnamese in two different restaurants, a significant topic of conversation would be whether the people last night had more fun, or whether the food in the other place was better. And there's just forking is this really weird set of issues. What else did they say? They said one other thing that's related to Rich's is this, you know, does this happen all the time? About the relationship between the developers and the users. It was a pretty vigorous statement. You can't trust anyone. Cannot trust. Why did they say that? What was it that made them say that? What experience?
So someone hacked in to the system.
But what the thing they'd never considered was that someone would go through 64K of assembler, tightly threaded machine code, not even as readable as C for small values of readable, to try and figure out how the game worked. And they realized that, I mean, it's this Abe's point about cheating, that there will always be some cheaters in any significantly large population. And so you're in this weird situation. It's an analogous situation the RIA is in of giving the thing you're trying to defend to the attacker in order for the system to work. So this is another odd characteristic. And it's more true in games where there's an obvious reward, however minimal it is, than it is in other social situations. But it's an interesting design problem faced in social systems generally. And now let me briefly turn our attention to Turbo Ted. What did you make of that? I find this thing fascinating, and every time I read it, it kind of gives me the shivers. Yeah,
I find it interesting because I just started getting into MySpace, which mm-hmm. seems to be like the because and I found the thing kind of annoying, but you know I want to see other people, friends of mine profiles, and then somebody was asking me, oh, why don't you set up your account? You know, so here I'm doing that, and then the next thing you know, I'm being attracted, like, people that aren't really my friends, that I don't really know, are coming to me, asking me to be my friend.
Why is that happening? Anyone who's used Friendster has had that experience. And also had the experience of Friendster telling you have 300,000 friends, which demonstrably you don't.
Yeah, the guy Tom who set up, he has, like, almost 2 million, and I was like, well, I didn't know he was the guy who created it, so I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, how do you manage that? How do you even...
Right, you don't. But why are people asking to be your friends if they don't know you?
Get a higher score.
Get a higher score. And why are you saying yes?
But what is a score. Friend? I mean, it's almost like Google. There is a number there.
That's exactly right.
But is it what we know what a friend is, or in the physical world, or is it totally your term?
There was a
social capital, I guess, in that.
There's like a gold structure built into these, which is
nonsense.
I'm kind of interested in particular in how businesses are trying to use this, because basically if you're a friend of a friend, you know, people go looking at their friends and saying, oh, I don't know that person. And, you know, it's social capital that is giving us pretty easy.
If you're using that LinkedIn Rise, and there's one that's specifically for salespeople about penetrating remote institutions, trying to figure out what social chain will get you an interview with a VP at a remote institution.
Always on?
No, it's not always on, although always on feature them. I forget it. But there are a bunch of businesses trying to use it. But why are people saying yes? If somebody came up to you at random on the street, right, David won't even lend out his phone.
If somebody came up to you and said, will you be my friend? What are you going to say? You can say no.
The point is that
I think a lot of people do say no.
Through this mediated environment, exactly, there is no risk, but there's a lot of back scratching. So you get all the rewards without actually.
There's no downside. And in fact, for a while, Friends for Now has its social moment. It seems to have passed, as I think presciently predicted in this article, but this essay. But there was a while where people were calling one another their friendsters.
Yeah.
In order to differentiate between the category of friend, which they wanted still to have some kind of meaning, and friendster, which simply meant we're an undirected graph to one another. That's about it. Dodgeball, interestingly, does not have that problem. It's also a social network, also works on friend-to-friend math, does not have the friendster problem as much. There are a couple of users in the system who generate a lot of outbound links. But what is about Dodgeball that works better than Friendster in terms of deflecting that kind of non-existent friend link?
Well, don't they have like a safe group?
I don't
think
you can move people to where you don't actually.
That's right. You could say yes, this person's a friend of mine, but don't tell me every time they walk into a bar because they're drunk or whatever.
There's consequences what you do in some way. Like, whereas friends, there's not. You know, there's no activity or anything like this, and there's a chance that these people come to wherever you are.
Right, right. Which is a big, big hole on. I mean, or a big, big hurdle on Dodgeball. I'm not going to friend somebody unless A, I am interested in finding out when they walk into a bar, and B, if I'm interested in having them walk in when I'm in a bar.
Does Dodgeball actually work? I'm still utterly unconvinced that it actually works.
Well, it works. It's interesting because they're really balanced in the they've got problems at both ends of the range. Too little and too much scale create problems for them. So they've got forking problems. But I've actually met people through Dennis without Dennis being present. So it works in because it works in transactions. The question is, are there enough transactions to keep the system viable?
I mean, I've been on it since almost day one, and I still haven't.
How often do you check in?
I never check in.
Oh, well, that's probably.
But I mean, people send me like everywhere. People send me crap, and I'm like, I checked in the one. My only experience I had with it, where it tried to work, is I was like, oh, I'm bored. I'll just put my location into Dodgeball, and somebody else was bored. We chased each other around the city for, like. Because like when you're actually someplace good, you don't think, oh, I'm going to go on Dodgeball and like check
right.
in.
Right.
Like, I'm having fun.
Right.
That's also the scale.
Right.
I mean, first, there's like worldwide, technically. And then Dodgeball has a limitation of
right.
where you
so
are.
So it narrows the universe, and then it gives you
penalties
for doing that. Right. But I mean, the thing that I loved about this article, in addition to the great observation that Friendster was a combination of narcissism, sycophancy, and voyeurism, was the complete feverish, like this person basically embodied the first 18 months of Friendster in this completely feverish, like, you know, and telling the story without sort of giving any of the backstory. It's like, I went out and bought a camera, and then I was staging photo shoots of myself to upload pictures twice daily. It was like, oh my God. But there was something about the speed of that infection. The fast infections also burn out fast. And I think that there's something really interesting about the potential for sociality unhinged from any actual dampening effects leads to these kind of fast-moving viruses, as it were, that don't last long.
Well, it's really addictive.
Yeah.
Weird. It was like remembering like what it was like to be addicted to this thing.
Right.
And to watch it spread. That was the most interesting thing to me, was watching Friendster spread, right?
Well, I gotta say, I go through phases, like some weeks I'm like, I'm on there and I'm updating my profile, and I wanna get to the top of that list.
Yeah.
I want people to see me, I want my friends to know I updated my profile, you know, I got a new hat.
Yeah. I saw Ann Pucheran using it in the lounge either last year or the year before, I forget. Did she overlap with you guys or not? And okay, so it was 2 years ago. And I asked her what she liked about it. And she said, oh, this is great because I can stay in contact with, you know, all my friends from high school. I was like, oh, I sort of got the impression that people weren't really using it as a communications tool. And she said, no, that's the great thing. We're connected, but we don't actually have to talk to each other. So it's like you can leave the link latent so you don't admit that you're in fact not, you know, stopping talking to that person, but it doesn't actually create any real world difficulties. So
I want to know what they're doing.
So Psychology of the Internet, this is the one of the two. There's another reading that I mentioned, but I'm pushing it off because we need to do more seriously Psychology of the Internet and Internet Paradox Revisited for next week. And obviously if you have questions, and particularly it's a little easier now with the two-week elapsed time, if you have questions or comments about your groups in the meantime, about the groups you look at in the meantime, drop me a line. And I'll see you all next Friday.
Do you have any
extra
copies of the reading?
I'm scared. Oh, that's weird. Is there an extra?
Because you were gone.
Is there an extra copy of the reading floating around? Did a pile end up? David, is that a?
No,
that's just one.
Because
I need to give one to Michael, so I'll go. I'll just go.
Oh, I took one for Michael.
You took one for Michael. Okay, great. Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.